Welcome everybody, and we will start with work session on House Bill 2270. We will not be moving the bill today. We have we have another set of amendments that are coming next week, and one person who is not able to testify on their amendments today. What I would like to do, though, while we have the folks here who are here, would be to go through each of the amendments and have a full explanation as to what those amendments do, so the committee is informed of the amendments before it. As soon as we get Elizabeth over here to kind of reset the stage. And then we'll just take them in order. Yeah, we're doing 2270. He's got a very nice, very helpful cheat sheet there.
Chairman Shetterly and committee members, I'll try to go through this handout beginning with dash one amendment, just to refresh everybody's memory with 2270. This is a historic property bill. And the dash one amendment, what this did was brought about by the League of Oregon Cities, and it retains the 1 day a year open house for residential properties. So that is keeping in statute current law, which is that there'll be 1 day a year for an open house. And the dash two amendment was by Parks and Revenue Department, and it's going to clarify the calculation of that ratio of maximum assessed value over the average real market value used to reset the assessed value after the property's completion of the first 15-year special assessment. It's going to also delete section 28, because we had testimony that that wasn't needed, on the conformance to the building code. Then the dash three amendment, what this is the one that was by John Tess, and it's the same as last session. You had Senate Bill 497A, and it's the same as section six, subsection two and three. And what this amendment is doing is it applies to historic properties already under special assessment, which also undergo new construction. So it provides a special assessment for the new construction. The new construction then becomes specially assessed. It has to, though, be approved by the State Historic Preservation Officer. And one of the things has to apply in the terms of it has to either be new construction used primarily for residential purposes or new construction for non-residential purposes. And then there's a criteria in there that the new construction has to, the special assessment will only apply to the square footage of the new construction when it is added, and the total net rentable area of the existing historic property is less than or equal to the total net rentable area that existed prior to the new construction. So that is a constraint that you cannot add on new rentable area in order for the new construction to qualify under this amendment. And with the dash four amendment, no one really wants this, but it's similar to the dash eight amendment, so I'll just address that dash eight amendment. With the dash five amendment, this is what Justin Burns testified to last time, and what this is allowing reapplication for a second 15-year historic special assessment for properties that originally were commercial properties. That's how they first came on the program. And then now they're no longer commercial properties, so they're residential properties. And this allows them then to have a second 15-year special assessment. The special assessment value in that second 15 years for those former commercial properties, now residential, shall be the same in both 15-year special assessment. That's different than the current bill that you have, where you would have that resetting of the special assessment in the second 15-year term. Then we had the dash 7 amendment, and this was by Alfred Staley. And what this amendment did, he had various smaller changes, but the bigger changes that he had in his amendment was providing a second 15-year historic special assessment for residential property owners. It conforms then the procedure for calculating that residential special assessment in the second 15-year term to the Section 8 of the existing bill, where you're going to be resetting then the assessed value in the second 15-year term for residential property. It's deleting Section 19 of the bill, and we didn't talk very much about Section 19, but this is ORS 197-772, And it, this, what this statute does is it currently provides an avenue for property owners to refuse to consent to historic property designation. So this is, what this statute also does is it puts in a statute of limitation time period where a once a property is removed from historic property designated, then the permit to demolish the property cannot be issued for 4 months. So this is something that wasn't really addressed during our last public hearing, but this was one component of his amendment. Then we have the Dash 8 amendment, which is John DiLorenzo's amendment, and this was the one about the applicability date. And what this does is it establishes an exemption from the changes in the bill for sections 2 through 6, 8 through 10, and 16 through 17 for those residential and commercial properties which have applied or reapplied for a second 15-year special assessment prior to the effective date of the measure.
Okay. Thank you.
And then there's a dash.
I'm sorry.
I'm not quite promise that we'll talk about it. But with, that's one that Representative Beck wanted, and it's dealing with the income tax credit for owners of historic property to complete the rehabilitation projects on the property.
Okay. Well, we will start at the top and take these one amendment at a time, and my inclination is to cherry-pick these, ones that didn't really clearly have committee support for. I just assumed go ahead and put into the bill so that those who are following them today will know that they're there and may not have to come back the next time. Others, we will defer action, and that will leave the proponents the opportunity to work the committee. So let's do it that way. So the fact that an amendment gets in, gets it in. If it's not in, that just means that the proponents will have some work to do between now and the next. Let's start with the Dash 1 amendments, proponents being League of Oregon Cities. Who wants to speak to those? Come on up. Anybody else, Michelle? Okay. Tell us what you've got.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the Dash 1 amendments merely replace language that was existing law that was taken out of House Bill 2270. We found among cities that have historic property, in many cases, the one-time per year annual viewing is really a community event. And some of our elected officials feel that this provides additional accountability for those folks who are receiving a property tax benefit. So.
Questions for Michelle? One I would have, how did that come out of the bill?
Mr. Chair, the interim work group, I believe, basically took a vote on this particular issue. We were not necessarily in the majority. There wasn't 100% consensus on this, obviously, but we were outvoted, and so that came out of the bill.
Mm-hmm. Questions for Michelle? Is there anyone here opposed to the Dash 1 amendments that would wish to speak to them? Chair, I would entertain a motion on the Dash 1 amendments.
Chair.
Representative Williams.
I would move the adoption of the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2270.
Dash 1 amendments. Representative Williams moves the Dash 1 amendments to House Bill 2270. Is there any objection? None. Okay, that takes us then to the Dash 2 amendments. Mr. Hammer.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, James Hamrick, State Historic Preservation Office. You all know that this tax incentive working group, we were moving rather fast. We didn't have a whole lot of time. And so the Dash 2 amendments do one thing that was not clarified before the group met, and we had to meet LC deadlines, and that was to delete the Section 28, which related to institutionalizing building code exemptions into the statute. At the time this was done, we were unaware that of the new appeals processes that had been put into place by the last legislature, and we believe in discussions with the department that our concerns about this issue can be handled without having to have it in the statute. And then the other piece of that relates to a request by the Department of Revenue just for a deletion of a couple of phrases in that one section. Elizabeth probably, which we actually just accepted, but we were not really consulted by revenue. But I think it's just a technical change.
Okay. Any questions, Mr. Hammond? Anybody here to testify against the Dash 2 amendments?
Mr. Chairman.
Representative Williams.
Move the adoption of the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2270.
Representative Williams moves the Dash 2 amendments to House Bill 2270. Is there any discussion? Any objection? Therein. That brings us to Dash 3 amendments. Who would like to speak to the Dash 3s? Yes. Oh, I'm sorry. This is coming up next time. Okay, we'll move on, certainly. I haven't gotten to my note on the Dash 3s yet. Okay, we will defer action on the Dash 3s until next time. Dash 4, do you want to just pass over those entirely for now? You're on 5 anyway. Okay, why don't you come on up? Let's start with number 5.
Number 5, we'd like to postpone to next time.
Okay. Then we'll pick up number 4 and number 8 at the same time. Number 7, Mr. Staley? Anybody here for Mr. Staley? Okay. John DiLorenzo, number 8 and number 4.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. For the record, my name is John DiLorenzo. I'm an attorney in Portland, and I am here to advocate the Dash 8 amendments to House Bill 2270. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, the Oregon lobby law requires me to disclose to you any circumstance in which I, as a lobbyist, also have a personal financial interest in legislation that I am lobbying, and so I am going to do that now. But please rest assured that notwithstanding the Oregon lobby law, I would have done so anyway.
Good idea.
I own the court.
Okay.
I am a 50% owner of a number of buildings in downtown Portland, two of which are on the National Historic Register. One is the Gentry Apartments at 12th and Taylor. It is a 60-unit apartment building. The other is the Commodore Apartments on 16th and Morrison. It consists of 70 apartment units and about a quarter block of retail space. I also represent numerous clients who own and preserve historic properties, and for that reason have a significant interest in this bill. The difference between the Dash 8 amendments before you and the Dash 4 amendments are only one word, and they are stylistic. Legislative Council originally drafted these amendments with the intention that the changes specified in the Act would apply prospectively to applications and reapplications made after the date of the Act. In the Dash 4s, the Legislative Council said that these changes apply to property classified as historic after the effective date. The Dash 8s say they only apply, and I prefer use of the word only apply, because to say they apply leaves open the question as to whether they might apply otherwise.
Actually, it says apply only.
Or apply only.
Okay.
Right.
Yeah.
So other than that, the two amendments are identical, and I prefer that we discuss the Dash 8s okay. with your permission.
Please.
I guess my first comment is that the purpose of tax incentive statutes are just that. They are not for the purpose of raising revenue. They were designed for the purpose of redirecting capital to purposes that otherwise would not have been expended in those areas had regular market forces been at work. And that's really the only reason why the tax code makes certain provisions for private economic behavior in certain areas and then provides rewards for that occurring. The Historic Preservation Program has been fairly successful in that regard. It has over the years redirected a significant amount of private capital towards preservation of historic properties. The Gentry, which I indicated minutes ago, is in its first year of its initial 15-year tax freeze, The Commodore is in the first year of its 15-year reapplication period. My partner and I have committed substantial resources to both preservation plans, and together they have probably amount, they probably will amount to over $1 million expended over a 15-year period. So we are not talking about insignificant amounts of resources that are dedicated to preservation plans for these buildings. Other owners who have entered into the initial term or the extended reapplication term have done the same through negotiations with the historic preservation officer in reliance upon the benefits that are provided by the statute. Now, the bill provides for a step up of assessments and provides for other other modifications to the program, which in my opinion, without some of the other amendments that I think you will be taking up, Representative Beck's amendments and others, without those amendments, pretty much, in my view, eliminate the attractiveness for any developer to really avail themselves of this program at this point. But that's a policy decision for you as to whether you wish to effectively eliminate the program or whether you wish to allow it to expire is a policy decision which you make prospectively. And, you know, it is up to you to weigh whether there is any longer a need, whether these types of incentives then are necessary to attract private capital to fulfill that need, and whether that's a desirable outcome. But whether your views are that, you know, this program should be continued or not continued, or benefits enhanced or not enhanced, the point is that there are many people who have relied upon a government promise and have changed their position to their detriment and have committed to expend significant amounts of resources to accomplishing a government goal. It is very important that private enterprise trust that the government will follow through with its commitments. We would hate to be in a situation where the rule of the day was buyer beware when dealing with the government. And so the purpose of the Dash 8s is to basically state that if, in fact, there has already been an application accepted or a reapplication accepted prior to the effective date of the Act, and if these parties have fulfilled their commitments with the state and have entered, in essence, into their side of the bargain, that the state will in turn provide its side of the bargain. That's all the Dash 8 amendments are intended to do.
Questions for Mr. DiLorenzo? Representative Witt.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. John, if we don't adopt the Dash 8s, what would happen in those situations?
Mr. Chairman, Representative Witt, I had a conversation with Dexter Johnson about that, and Mr. Johnson drafted the 2270. And when I called him, I pointed out that normally there is language in tax bills that determine whether they are meant to have prospective or retrospective effect. This bill is silent on that. There is some doubt as to whether a new change today would be able to impact a prior deal anyway. However, it is very possible, given the language of the bill, that these minimum assessed values and Measure 50 assessed values would in fact be stepped up midway through the program. And Mr. Johnson agreed with me that the bill could stand some clarification, and it's for that reason that the amendments were drafted, just to make absolutely sure that this is intended to have prospective application, not retrospective impact.
I can't remember from our last conversation on this, does this have an effective, is there a specified effective date in this bill? So would this be January 1?
I didn't see one in the bill itself, okay. Chairman.
And I don't recall.
And that was one of the reasons why we were so concerned about having the Dash 8s. This bill would ordinarily be effective 90 days following sine die.
January 1.
January 1 would be now the new law.
Last session.
Thank you.
The question I would have on the Dash 8s, just to get things started here, John, is without you hearing about your argument is reliance, I guess. What, I'm not sure that reliance is necessarily the watchword if we're talking about an application that is made and an assessment that's made, let's say, between the date that we pass this bill and January 1 of next year, if the argument you were right. You're about 15 seconds late, Dexter.
I timed you, Dexter. I said 30 seconds and it took you 45.
Okay, do you want to come on up, Mr.? I guess if the justification here is equity and reliance on a benefit that was presumed, would it make more sense to choose a date earlier than the effective date, given the effective date is still going to be 9 months out?
Mr. Chairman, you could, but you assume then that buyers and sellers are cognizant of all of the deliberations occurring at the legislature, and it has, you know, pretty much been, and this is my personal feeling, it's been my personal feeling that whenever the state passes statutes that are designed to manipulate economic behavior, parties in the economic realm rely upon statutes, and they structure their transactions accordingly. And so, it's my general view that whenever a prospective change is made, it's always wise to consider whether a transition rule is desirable or not to protect those who have in fact relied upon it. So, I guess my that's a long-winded way of saying that it would be my preference to leave the language as is, because there are people out there who rely on the statutes as printed, and their lawyers still rely, and their lawyers are usually not aware, frankly, of what is occurring here.
Dexter, do you want to? I guess we invited you. You didn't. Do you want to address?
The only thing, Mr. Chair, that I wanted to mention was that although there is no applicability date, the bill does carry an effective date that is actually, which all bills do, even when they're silent, that based on a change made last session would be January 1.
Yeah. Well, when I say it didn't have a date, I mean it didn't have another date.
Right.
So the default date is January 1. Any other questions for Mr. DiLorenzo or Mr. Johnson? Anybody else wish to testify on the Dash 8 amendments? Marge.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. I'm Marge Cafori, Government Relations Director for the City of Portland. With respect to the Dash 8 amendments, I do want to point out just a couple of things here, and I've been giving this particular amendment a lot of thought. This is an amendment that we originally thought affected about 5 properties in Portland. We now know that there are about 67 properties statewide that would be grandfathered by this particular provision. I just wanted you to be aware of that impact as you deliberate about this particular bill. Mr. DiLorenzo has given you a wonderful civics lesson about how government works and what taxation policy is all about. He may be right, he may be not right. I leave it to you, obviously, to decide whether you wish to grandfather these 67 properties, but I would urge you that if you choose to do that, to limit it to approximately those 67 properties that are in their second 15 years of their 30-year period, and try to limit it to about those 67 properties.
Okay. Questions for? Yes.
I have a question. I was under the understanding that these amendments would have the 30 years apply to both properties that are now applying in their first 15 and properties that are applying in their now. Okay.
All right. Sure. Let's clarify that.
Chairman, Representative Kafuri, although that would, ultimately be my preference, Marge has told me forget about it. I believe the way the amendment is written is that it will apply only to property classified and assessed as historic property pursuant to an application or a reapplication filed on or after the effective date of the Act. So the way I understand this amendment
is that, for instance, with the gentry, we're in our first 15-year period. If we reapply 15 years hence, we will be subject to the new provisions of the new bill if this bill is passed and enacted. However, if we filed either an application or a reapplication before the effective date of this act, then the old law would apply to what was done in reliance upon the old law. That's my understanding as to how the amendments work.
Thank you.
Mr. Hammer, come up for a second. I'm sure you're not privy to what discussions might be happening up there among buyers and sellers, but I'm curious to know if there are any pending transactions of which you're aware that you might have been contacted about for preliminary information or...
Mr. Chairman, as you might suspect, we really don't usually have that information unless a prospective buyer is examining whether or not a project that the prospective buyer wants to undertake might qualify for one of our tax incentives. And that does happen, but say, for instance, a single building, it might happen once or twice, or if the building doesn't sell, then it might happen again the next year with someone else. So we never really find out until the deal is done.
Okay. How long does it take? What's the application process timeline? How long does it take in a given case?
To apply for special assessment, mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman.
To get the plan approved.
The applications currently under the existing law are accepted January the 1st to April the 1st unless there's a real estate transaction that is in process after that time. And so there is a window in which you can actually apply for July 1st for a few properties. The Historic Assessment Review Committee, which is an in-house committee which reviews these applications, starts meeting generally in March or April, and generally meets until August, and probably once every 4 to 6 weeks, and they process these applications. The law states now that we have to approve all applications by September the 15th of the calendar year.
But the July 1 is the drop-dead date?
It is the drop-dead date and only applies to properties that are in the process of being transferred.
John? How about July 1?
Mr. Chairman, that's probably fine. I just don't know whether this is really an academic discussion or a real one, because Mr. Hamrick will know anything else that's in the queue, I guess, and the time period for gaining these approvals is fairly lengthy. So it might be interesting to know what's in the queue.
I guess I'm thinking of an application date of July 1. Mm. I don't mean to make this any worse.
Mr. Chairman, forgive me for interrupting, but one of the things that the bill does currently, and which we used to be able to do, was to accept applications year-round. The current bill actually goes back to that process where, because it eliminates the Historic Assessment Review Committee and allows the processing of applications to be an administrative affair, and thus we feel like it will actually speed up the whole process. Because that's the way it used to run before 1995. So just wanted to let you know that that's in the bill.
Well, Mr. Chairman, in light of that, obviously my interests are protected if you put in July 1.
Mm-hmm.
Philosophically, I still have the same concerns, but, they may be, again, more academic than real. So, again, my only concern is there are those out there, no one knows who they are, who will be relying upon what's printed in the statute, and they will be in for quite a surprise if on January 1 or when the ORS is reprinted. So let's say that's in October or November, they find out that they had to structure their transaction by July 1 instead of prospectively. So, I mean, that would be my only concern, and I would be worried about lawyers committee malpractice and the like. But other than that, my interest would be protected, so I guess I can't be held to object, but heard to object. But philosophically, I would prefer this, but y'all are decision makers, so make whatever decision you think is best.
Well, we'll ponder up here for a second. Marge, do you want to say anything more on that? I want to balance that against, I guess, creating a rush.
Right.
Right.
To apply and get that 30-year, the fire sale is on for the next 9 months, and get your application in while the going's good.
Mr. Chairman, thank you. Marge Gaffori again. I do want to say a couple of things. I think you could say the same thing that Mr. DiLorenzo was saying about almost anything that the legislature passes. You're going to either pay attention or you're not. You're either going to have ORS shock or you're not. You know, everything that is done down here is not held up to the bright light of day and made known to everybody that might have an interest. I think that people who do have historic properties, either commercial or residential, are pretty aware of what is going on with historic property law. They tend to follow this because it's in their economic interest to do so. We are afraid that there could potentially be an application rush. There is a substantial difference between one 30-year tax abatement and two 15-year abatements with a readjustment between period one and period two. If you imagine what your property might have been worth 30 years ago or even 15 years ago, you can appreciate how much appreciation there has been in property over that period of time and how much tax benefit there really is accruing to these owners. So I would say that anything that you could do to help out by limiting the number of properties that could grandfather under the existing law and applying this law at the earliest possible date would be appreciated by local government.
Thank you. I am divining that the sense of the committee is to establish a cutoff date, and maybe between now and the next time we have this up, we could go with July 1. It sounds good to me. A nod of the head that would accommodate both those transactions that may be in the pipeline, but without necessarily creating a gold rush.
Mr. Chairman, then this final comment is only meant to be helpful.
As are all of your comments.
So the other ones weren't? No, this one is devoid of self-interest. The others were replete with it. helpful, nevertheless. I think that if we talk about the problem of a rush of applications, first of all, the rush of applications would either be for a reapplication for an extent of 15 years or for an initial application,
right?
Because certainly no one would be able under these amendments to avail themselves of a 30-year period. They'd only have a 15-year period or a 15-year reapp period. And one policy question you might want to consider is whether that's all that bad. If you have a situation, for instance, in which you have a piece of property that does qualify for historic treatment, if the consequence of a rush to apply will be to freeze the property tax where it is presently, and in exchange for that obtain a significant commitment from the owners to rehabilitate that property, depending on your views on whether the credit is, or whether the freeze is a good program or not, that might not be a bad result. You know, I guess a lot of it has to do with whether you believe in the historic tax credit program and its effectiveness and its goals to begin with. So that might not be a bad result, because all you're doing is just freezing them where they are currently.
Yes, I would like to respond to that. I guess we're having a point-counterpoint.
Okay, that's all right. This is all about.
I can appreciate what Mr. DiLorenzo is saying. However, the market in Portland is replete with people who are looking for historic properties. They are in very significant demand. They are hard to find. They are extraordinarily attractive for investors. I can't think that we need to apply even more incentives than the ones that already exist to encourage people to find these properties and rehabilitate them and restore them. So I just go back to my initial point.
Okay. Oh, yeah, sure.
If, and this might be for Director, if the Dash 8 amendment was not passed, how would that affect people applying for their first special assessment?
Dexter, I think it was for you.
Or Marge. You can both answer.
Mr. Chair, Representative Corey, if the amendments were not passed, the bill would take effect on January 1, and initial applications would be controlled by the law as set forth in the bill from that date forward. While I'm up here, there is one comment, if I may, Mr. Chair, make on the Dash 8 amendments. I just want to make sure you're all aware that under current law, there are two laws that apply when you are reapplying for the second 15-year period. Under the one, which is a temporary provision just for certain properties that for which the reapplication was made between 1995 and 1997, it's clear that you get the 30-year period. But under the more general law, right now it's not at all clear as to whether you get the 30-year or the 15-year period. And so the Dash 8 amendments would not necessarily answer in a definitive way whether you're going to get a 30-year period or a 15-year period. It's really in the court's hand, right?
Huh. Do you want to ask that question on the record?
The water's muddy.
Yeah.
I don't know if you want a colloquy here.
Oh.
Doesn't the rest of the bill answer that, though, that question?
For periods going forward.
Right.
So does that infer that the law is different currently? I guess is that the question?
Well, I think the court would, if this were an issue in front of the court would look at the law that was applicable at the time,
mm-hmm.
not what okay. The legislature has done since.
All right. Well, let's go ahead and hold these off until we get next. Sounds like there may be a little bit more to iron out anyway on these, at least to help have a better understanding of what they do. Okay, so we'll hold off on the Dash 8s, come back to those, and let's go to the Dash 9s. Representative Beck.
Mr. Chair, this was after some contemplation. I thought we'd put these on the table. These are pretty significant amendments, and there's no one here to testify, I don't think. There was some testimony about establishing a tax credit for historic preservation activities, and I just thought it would be good to put this on the table. I believe the way this is structured, you would get a 20% tax credit based on the amount of investment you make into a building. Now, this is the sort of proposal that, you know, one conceivably we could do in lieu of the property tax program or phase out the property tax program, and we wanted to promote historic preservation, move forward a tax credit-based program, which, given their Measure 50, may make more sense, be more of an incentive, or this could be in addition to the current property tax program. It's just another bone to throw at historic preservation. We would need a fiscal.
I was going to ask if I didn't see a fiscal impact.
Just got these today, so there is no fiscal. We can't really discuss them. I just wanted to have it on the table, some public record. Maybe when we meet again, there will be some people who want to come testify for this.
Okay. Anybody wish to speak to the Dash 9s ending today? They just come out as today's date, I guess, so nobody will have any time to...
All right.
We'll bring these back up. Brad Higby, do you want to come up and speak to Amendment X?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee... Thought you'd escaped. I don't have a cast of thousands like previously, but Marge Kefouri on behalf of the City of Portland is here to back up some of the things that I'll be saying, hopefully not too recklessly. Brad Higbee appearing today on behalf of Robert Ball. Testimony is forthcoming that he was kind enough to prepare last night regarding hopefully a non-controversial amendment that I would humbly request that the committee consider adopting House Bill 2270. In brief, Bob Ball is the owner of an historic warehouse property in the city of Portland. He's in the 13th year of his 15-year abatement period and is interested in moving forward on a new and exciting plan to refurbish the building, and has essentially submitted for what I'm calling pre-approval with the state, that particular plan to keep the building consistent with the historical character and to greatly improve the facility. He's been working closely with the city of Portland. I believe there's a grant from the Portland Development Commission to assure that there'll be below market housing available in addition to market. And the particular issue that I'm hoping to address today, Mr. Chair, is this. If he, and I might add, Mr. Chair, that I apologize for not appearing on his behalf a couple, 3 weeks ago, but I think he's just learned the significance of the issue that affects him as of, frankly, yesterday. Under the current situation, he was told and he believed that if he withdrew from the program in this, the 13th year, and reapplied with a new plan for another 15-year period, he would be initially, he thought, subjected to the requirement to repay the benefit, essentially the taxes, that the property didn't have to pay for the preceding time period. What he was just informed, however, was that in addition to that, he would be obliged to pay not only the taxes, but the penalties and interest. That's significant in that the back taxes, essentially, that are owed are $414,000. He was told that the total package would actually be about $1 million. The option that he has is to sit on the property, do nothing for the next 2 years, wait out the termination of the 15-year period, essentially not owe anybody a nickel under the program, and then reapply for another 15-year period. What he would prefer to do, however, and I believe this works closely in connection with what the city of Portland is trying to do in essentially the Pearl District and bringing around some of those properties, is voluntarily withdraw from the 15-year program, agree to pay the back taxes, hopefully avoid the obligation to pay the interest and penalties, and then proceed on a tight timeline to rehabilitate the property and make it habitable, hopefully within the next year or so. The draft amendments that Robert Ball's lawyer, Steve Janik, was kind enough to draft yesterday, which I understand are sitting eagerly awaiting the official drafting process in LC as I speak, very briefly suggests that a property owner voluntarily withdrawing from the program would not be obliged essentially to pay the penalties and interest, so-called, if certain conditions were met, and basically the big two are he or she agrees to pay the back taxes, and that he or she has submitted or is submitting another plan for another 15-year period that's approved by the state. Then and only then, we believe, that would be a limiting factor, meaning not too many properties would, frankly, be eligible for this sort of thing. He would then be able to move forward with another 15-year plan.
Well, your amendment also addresses the qualification that the preservation plan contemplates the expenditure of at least 5 times the amount of interest that would have been payable.
Right. That was, again, that was, Mr. Chair, wholly his suggestion as a way to, thanks for pointing it out as well, to make sure that there is an obligation for a property owner to not necessarily try to game the system, but there's a serious commitment to reinvest in the property and not only have it comply with the historical guidelines that the state and the city have, but also to make sure that he's doing something, he or she is doing something serious to the property. Okay. I might, if I could, and I'll be happy to answer any questions. Marge, I don't know if you have anything particular to add.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Marge Kafoury, City of Portland. I do want to add just a couple of things here. As Brad pointed out, the Portland Development Commission is investing $1 million in this property. At least a third of the units in the property will be below market properties. The rest will be market rate. It's an important addition in this area for the city to add some lower-income housing. It's sort of on the edge of the Pearl District, Mr. Chairman. It's close to the new Lovejoy Ramp area that we're reconstructing downtown. The initial building, the underlying building, has been fallow for a number of years. Not a whole lot has happened there, primarily because of the surrounding area. But now, because of the streetcar going in that general area and another a number of other improvements that we are making in the area, this is a very important project for the city and for the neighborhood. Repayment of the taxes does, in fact, start the clock over again, if you will. As a warehouse, this would be eligible for two 15-year periods. As housing, it is eligible only for one 15-year period. So by paying the back taxes, this, in effect, wipes out the initial 15-year period, and the owner can start over again as a new use. The payment of interest would make the lower-income units not be able to pencil out the way we are hoping they are. So that's why we're supporting this amendment.
Okay. Questions for either Ms. Foy or Mr. Higby on the Dash X amendments? All right, we'll look forward to those then. This is going to be up. Just to recap, we have moved in the Dash 1 and Dash 2 amendments. The Dash 4 amendments have been withdrawn. The Dash X amendments are not before us. We'll conclude action on the other amendments that are ready and prepared for presentation at the next work session. It'll be the final work session on this bill. And, Paul, that'll be a week from Monday. Is that right? The 19th. Okay. So, thank you, everybody, for helping to illuminate the committee on... very better this time than we did at the end of the last one. Okay, thank you very much. That will close that's right, yeah. Work session on House Bill 2270. Let's go on to a work session on House Bill 2208. Elizabeth, that's you again, isn't it?
Yep. Mr. Chairman and committee members, with House Bill 2208, we have some amendments, so I'll go through the four different amendments with this bill. To begin with, the Dash 1 amendment is clear. We had already had the Dash 1 amendment the last time we had this bill up, and it's clarifying the amount of property taxes that are paid by the Department of Revenue and the county records that they will not be subject to the disclosure laws in 314.835. And then with the Dash 2 amendment, what this is addressing is the issue that we've been talking about with the senior deferral program and those income limits. And what it's doing is establishing then this the initial threshold for the for property tax payers to, when they first come on to the program of the senior deferral program, the income limit is currently under law $27,500. But that is not indexed in the sense that the higher maximum limit is of the $32,000. So what this the Dash 2 amendment does is it indexes it so that the total property taxes deferred shall be reduced 50 cents for each dollar that the participant's household income exceeds the maximum limit initially to come on the program of $27,500. This applies in tax years July 1st. 2002. And then with the Dash 3 amendment, this is going to extend the sunset date out 10 years from July 1st, 2002 to 2012 for tribal land when the landowner has applied to have the tribal land held in U.S. trust. It is deleting the provision of how a property tax refund shall be made to the taxpayer. Mm-hmm. And then finally, in the Dash 4 amendment, what this is doing is this is allowing, when we had the testimony from Elizabeth Harchenko on some issues with the ERA program and the nonprofit homes, this is allowing then the payments of the ERA program or the nonprofit homes for the elderly to be reduced proportionally so that the payments paid shall not exceed the amount of monies for the two programs. So basically, with these amendments, the Dash 1 is... doesn't have any revenue impact. With the Dash 2, when we're having the indexing then where you wouldn't have a clear cutoff of getting into the senior deferral program of $27,500, what you would then have would be seniors would come on to the program at having only a partial amount of their property taxes deferred. And so then what you would see then is there would be kind of a different income threshold for different seniors or disabled persons, depending on the property tax liability that they had. So if they had a more expensive home, they would have more property taxes to pay, so then they could have a higher income level to first come on the program than someone who had a lower income, lower assessed value of a home and a smaller amount of property taxes, then their income level could only be a little bit above $27,500 in order to qualify for the program. So it is a change that makes it a little bit harder for Department of Revenue to go about and administering initially whether or not people are qualifying for the program. And then with the Dash 3 amendment, the extending the sunset date out 10 years for tribal land under application to be placed in the U.S. Trust with the federal government, this would result in only a minimal reduction in property taxes of less than about $50,000, and that's from the property tax expenditure report. And then with the Dash 5 amendment, the Dash 4 amendment, allowing both payments of the nonprofit homes for the elderly and the elderly rental assistance program to be prorated, this would just result in, if there was a need to have proration, a reduction in payments to the nonprofit homes for the elderly and less of a reduction in the elderly rental assistance program participants.
As to the Dash 4 amendments, I'll just say that following our last meeting on this, Senator Ferrioli and I have a weekly meeting with the co-chairs of Ways and Means, and they were not able to give us assurance that they would be able to fully fund this program to meet both the elderly rental assistance and the nonprofit homes' anticipated needs. And so that's why the Dash 4 provides for prorating of the ERA program or the nonprofit homes. Senator Brown, you are here, and I understand that you want to testify on the Dash 3 amendments, in which case we will take them out of order and welcome you.
Thank you very much. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, committee members. For the record, I'm State Senator Kate Brown. I represent Senate District 7, Southeast and Northeast Portland. I'm here today to speak in support of the proposed Amendment Dash 3, which you should all have in front of you, the House Bill 2208. This amendment would extend the exemption until the year 2012 on lands acquired by an Indian tribe, as long as the land is located within the ancient tribal boundaries of the tribe and the land is transferred to a trust administered by the United States. So it's a fairly narrow exemption. And I'm here today on behalf of the Confederated Tribes of the Coos, Lower Umpqua, and Siuslaw Indians, and the chair, Ron Brainerd, is in the back of the room. They are one of the Oregon's 9 federally recognized Indian tribes and have a membership of approximately 700 individuals. The Confederated Tribes were restored to federally recognized status by an act of Congress in 1984. Their former homelands comprise about 1.6 million acres in the Coos River, Lower Umpqua River, and Siuslaw River watersheds. They are the only Oregon tribe today that has never received compensation for the loss of their land, and the only coastal Oregon tribe that does not have a land base. So, colleagues, this amendment is very critical in terms of their ability to continue to acquire lands within their traditional ancestral land base, and we would certainly ask that you approve the amendment. Mr. Chair, I would be happy to answer any questions if I'm able. My understanding is that there's no objection from other folks, from the sponsors of the bill, to this particular amendment.
This particular hitchhiker?
Yes.
I don't recall talking about this. But yeah, that's right. I don't recall talking about this issue when the bill was first up. This is...
Mr. Chair, we're trying to save on all those taxpayer dollars in terms of bill drafts. Yes.
Are there questions for Senator Brown on the Dash 3 amendments?
Thanks.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Yeah. All right, let's go back to the top and ask John Phillips. And, you don't want to come up? And Ms. Leeper, welcome back.
Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, my name is John Phillips with the Oregon Department of Revenue, Property Tax Division, and this originally was the department's bill. taken quite a few number of changes, and recently we were contacted by Karen Quigley with the Commission for the Indians, and they asked if there was a bill that we were aware of that could be amended, and we said there's one that's being amended several times over, and this is a good one, too. So we offered this one up, and that's why that amendment that Senator Brown was talking about came to you. We've also gotten amendments, Representative Witt's amendment as a dash two, and I'm just having some comments passed out about that, and perhaps we can answer questions or supply information on that. Shirley Leapers again with me. She represents the deferral program. Mm-hmm. What our comments are on the dash two amendments are that we're just describing the difference for you at the top of the handout there. Household income 27.5 or less, there's a full deferral. And age 62 or older is the age threshold. The dash two would create an incremental or partial deferral over 27.5 at 50 cents for each dollar in excess of that amount. We did a lot of thinking about this, and we want to talk about some issues relative to that suggestion and offer up another possible amendment or suggestion, and that is just to think about the program and how to make an efficient program and maybe simplify it and less confusing for seniors. I just want to throw out the consideration that if you bump up the threshold to, let's say, $32,000, you would eliminate this 50 cents on the dollar calculation. It would give the seniors some more certainty as to what they might get. They wouldn't have to wait until the tax statements were issued. And it would also then track with the after the initial year, it would track with that threshold in the second year, which is also $32,000. And then they would both accelerate at the CPI each year and be the same amount after that. So that's just a suggestion. We're open to whatever your wish is on that, but just trying to offer up some ideas for simplifying it.
Representative Wood.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chairman. In effect, the $32,000 or $32,500, whichever one it is, which is the maximum amount you can earn once you have already qualified for the program, right? So in the subsequent year, what you're suggesting is maybe you make that the entry level amount to qualify the first year.
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, yes, $32,000.
The current law, I believe, when you go above the $32,000 on a subsequent year, that you lose 50 cents deferral for each dollar of income. That's why I came back with the dash two amendments, you know, that recognize that same principle in terms of getting someone initially qualified for the deferral program. Do you think it would be simpler just to go to the same standard, I guess is what your testimony is?
Mr. Chair, Representative Witt, yes, we do think it would be simpler, and the threshold, the $32,000 seemed like a reasonable threshold because it matched the other one, but it's your decision as to a policy on what's a, you know, which income threshold population you're trying to benefit by the...
Yeah, Mr. Chairman, I mean, I see that as a friendly move to where this amendment's going. What I'm trying to do is address the situation where someone is close to the current threshold, they're disabled, they're senior, they don't quite qualify, they would qualify for a renewal to make it easier for them to get on to the program initially for a senior or disabled person. So, I mean, if we went to $32,000 in terms of the qualification, that's getting even more than what I had requested, and I wouldn't say no to that.
Administratively, it seems simple.
Yeah. The other point, Mr. Chairman, is we're talking here about revenue impact local government. Well, the actual revenue impact isn't on local government,
right.
It's on the state.
On the state. And I guess what that means, if we're bringing, we have here 225 new applicants, I guess what that means is, well, the potential impact would be a lower benefit payable across the board to everybody if you end up prorating benefits, and now you're prorating among 225 additional participants. Is that what it boils down to?
Yeah. Chair and committee, if you prorated it on those that would come under Mr. Witt's proposal, they would be prorated then. What we're proposing is if the household income limit for new applicants coming on the program was raised, they would receive 100% of their taxes deferred. Then for the second year and thereafter, they would have the federal adjusted gross income test to meet.
I guess what I mean by prorating them, if the Ways and Means Committee doesn't appropriate sufficient funds to pay everybody out at 100%, then you will prorate, isn't that right?
We don't prorate now under the deferral program. It's out of our other funds revolving account.
Oh, it is.
Payments are made from.
Okay.
Yeah. I might say
this is not one you need to come back to the e-board for.
The program has been self-funded.
Okay, that's helpful to me then. All right.
Mr. Chairman, yeah. I'd point out the program was running in the black.
Mm-hmm, right.
To get this program expanded out to disabled people, I think we had to go through Ways and Means and get some appropriation for that, I think. Because I think at one point the legislature grabbed the reserves that were in the program that had built up through the interest charges that were collected and the principal that was collected upon sales of the residences. But it seemed to me last session there was a need for an appropriation to support this, and I think the bill went through Ways and Means. It was House Bill 2901.
Mr. Chair and Representative Witt, not last biennium, but the biennium before, we did have excess money in the revolving account. We did give back $10 million to general fund. This past biennium, I don't recall or don't know for sure if there was an appropriation there, but we have not had to use any appropriations to cover the payments or anything for this biennium.
Well, do you have some light to shed on this? You're moving this way. It must mean something.
Mr. Chair, last planning, we did have $10 million in the general fund revenue forecast. So that when steps were taken, that was reduced. If some of that has another claim on it. So what we need to do on this is see what's in the current forecast, what they've assumed, if there's going to be a transfer or not. If not, then that won't show up on that.
Mr. Chairman? Yeah, last session, the 2901 didn't take effect until January
2001. Starting into that cycle.
So it started this year, mm-hmm. Right, and that was the expansion to disabled homeowners, mm-hmm. Low-income disabled homeowners. So consequently, I would have thought that in the current biennium, the program is probably running the black, because there hasn't been much yet put out to expand it out for the disabled. In the meantime, we've been collecting benefits from the interest charges on the seniors who've been in the program for a long time.
Well, if we're going to make a further amendment to look at raising that to 32, we can look at that appropriation or funding issue at the same time.
Yep.
Make sure we're not creating a problem and going that direction. Yeah.
Yeah, that's my concern, Mr. Chairman. I mean, I try to target this as nearly as I could, and using the 50 cents on a dollar for the initial qualification so that we can get some more people qualified for the program. Subsequent years, obviously, it gets easier as they go up to the threshold of 32. I guess my only concern is in going to 32 for the initial qualification is we're creating a significant impact here in terms of dollars that will have to go through Ways and Means to support that expansion.
Maybe, or maybe not.
I'm going to ask, excuse me, Mr. Chair, members of the committee, I'm going to ask Shirley to confirm this, but my understanding would be that this suggestion is just for the initial application year, so it would cover the people between 27.5 and 32 in 1 year only. After that, everybody there would be no more money paid out in any subsequent years.
All right.
That's correct.
Okay, that's true.
That's true.
All right, well, let's take a look at that. Let's see what that does if we move the initial qualification amount to the 32. Okay. Representative Bates, you had a comment.
I'm just not sure I understand this. I want to make sure I do. If an individual is making $32,001, do they get no deferment then?
Under the possible recommendation, they would get no benefit. They would not be able to come on the program if they were over the 32,000 total household income.
Well, follow up. Mm-hmm. I don't want to speak for you. Under your suggestion, they would continue to get at a reduced rate something after 32,000.
Well, once they're in the program. Yeah.
Well, maybe so we can clarify that. I think I understand this. Under current law, if you're over 27.5, you don't get on the program.
Right.
Period. So what my bill would do is it would allow you to get a 50-cent benefit for every additional dollar of income in terms of being able to access a deferral. So it makes it easier to get on the program.
Right.
Once you're on the program, you can go up to $32,000. Current program says if you're over $32,000, you get the 50-cent benefit for each dollar of income.
Right. So there is that there in the present program.
For a second or subsequent request for a deferral after you're already on the program. Right.
Okay, well, let's take a look at that. I think that's moving in the right direction. Okay, anything else on the dash twos?
Mr. Chair, no. I have a comment, though, that just might be helpful, and it's on the third page, I believe, of the handout, just for future discussions and maybe this one. There are 9 other bills that are out there dealing with, actually including this one, dealing with either senior deferral or deferral of taxes for elderly or these kinds of proposals that just kind of... if you weren't aware of, that you might want to be aware of. And several of the issues are thresholds, what the income threshold should be, what the age threshold should be, and many of them have different thresholds. So just for your interest and consideration, it's helpful for us in administering the program if we have some consistency. We appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Mr. Chairman, my hope would be that we could use this vehicle, House Bill 2208, to make a policy decision on the dash twos, either in their current form or by going to a $32,000 entry threshold.
Okay.
Thank you very much.
Thank you. Dash three amendments, we've heard about the dash four amendments. Deborah.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Deborah Buchanan, Department of Revenue. I would just like to mention that the program, the Elderly Rental Assistance Program, is working on a suggestion to bring back to you regarding some options we might use for funding that. I think one of those would include perhaps prorating the nonprofit elderly homes payment. So that's probably just fine. If you wanted to go ahead and do this, I'm not sure that what they would bring back would necessarily conflict with that. So we expect...
I mean, we could move these in today, you're saying.
Right, and then my understanding is if you chose not to prorate the elderly rental assistance payments, that could be accomplished in Senate Bill 425, even though this does provide for prorating. And we should have that ready in the next couple of weeks, perhaps, to bring back to you in Senate Bill 425.
Well, I tell you, why don't we set this one down for a week from Monday as well, and let's see if that's ready at the same time, and we can just make sure we get these coordinated. Okay, so we'll defer action on any of these amendments today, but we'll bring them all back then, including the dash. Anybody, that'll give everyone a chance to think about the dash threes, since we just saw them for the first time today. I was going to ask, is it, you know, or we got... Michelle and Hasina, the local governments, do you know anything? Do they care about the Dash 3 amendments? That's the tribal lands? No, okay. Yeah. All right, well, we'll defer action on any of these amendments then until we bring this back up, and we'll close the work session on House Bill 2208 and go to a work session on House Bill 2347. Elizabeth?
Okay. With House Bill 2347, nothing has changed. We have no amendments. So basically, to just remember again what this bill does.
We have amendments, but
no new amendments. Okay. This is the same bill that you saw the last time we had a hearing on this. It is allowing the surviving spouse of a deceased disabled person who is receiving Social Security survivor benefits to be eligible for the property tax deferral program. So it's just making that small change as far as allowing if the disabled person has Social Security survivor benefits to be allowed to on this program. This change applies to the deferral of taxes beginning on or after July 1st, 2001. This revenue impact should be minimal. You have to fiscal impact that we didn't have the last time. But basically, there's only going to be a few disabled persons who might have chosen to have Social Security survivor benefits as opposed to Social Security disabled benefits.
fiscal impact. I see the revenue impact statement dated February 27. Here's the fiscal.
I have a no fiscal, Mr. Chair.
Yeah, so do I. Is that,
okay.
There's no fiscal. Okay. Just want to make sure I wasn't missing something. All right, then I don't think we took any action on this, so the dash one amendments are before us.
Mr. Chair.
Representative Kifori.
Move the dash one amendments to House Bill 2347.
Representative Kifori moves the dash one amendments to House Bill 2347. Is there any discussion? Any objection? So ordered. Representative Kifori.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2347 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation.
Representative Kifori moves House Bill 2347 as amended to the floor with a due pass recommendation. Is there discussion? Please call the roll.
Representative Say.
Aye.
Yeah.
Aye.
Brown.
Mm-hmm.
Aye.
William.
Aye.
Aye.
Hughes.
Aye.
Aye. House Bill 2347 goes to the floor. Is there a volunteer to carry? Representative Witt. You got it. We are out of work session. Just for the committee's information, point on marking progress in the session. We have our we have our first motion for concurrence coming up tomorrow on our House Bill 2031 that's already been to the Senate and back with amendments, and I'll move to concur, but be the first one up, and that's kind of fun. And it's a sign of progress that we are getting to concurrence motions now. Isn't that great? Next will come veto overrides. And then we'll know we're getting toward the end.
So I have a question, Mr. Chairman.
Yeah.
Does that mean that we did something wrong in that bill?
No, I don't know. No. No, we did not do anything wrong.
Okay.
Yeah. We did not.
Oh, no.
We did not do anything wrong. No. Okay?
Yes. All right. I trust.
Okay, with that, then I will adjourn the meeting and see you all tomorrow.